John Reimer is the Inspector General at the Department of Defense. I'm joined by Brian Miller of Navigant, the former Inspector General at the General Services Administration. Mr. Reimer, thank you very much for your time today. Let's start first with the scope and mission of the Office of Inspector General of the Department of Defense, the authority that you have to conduct audits and investigations in DOD. Thank you for your time, sir.
Yeah, absolutely, certainly, and thank you. Scope and mission, the DOD IG, just like the other 70 or so IGs in the federal government, exists to identify waste, fraud, and abuse in the programs and operations of the department. Here, it's a little different, though. We have lots of other folks helping us. My background, I spent, my first appointment was in 2006. I was appointed the Inspector General at the FDIC, so I became familiar with the function and the mission. When I got to the DOD a couple of years ago, though, I realized same mission, it's scope that's different. Here and scope and size, and also we have a large number of folks that help us at in most agencies. The IG is represents the only investigators or the only auditors in the organization. Here we have some 12,000 others that are in the accountability and oversight business that are outside the direct control of the IG. Those include all the uniformed IGs. There are IGs in several of the department's agencies. It would also include the military criminal investigative organizations, the Criminal Investigative Division in the Army, NCIS in the Navy. So very big accountability community within the department. That's probably what sets this apart from most other IGs. And then just the size of the department itself. When you talk about the Department of Defense, you have to think in terms of, both the dollars, which is approaching $600 billion budget for the operating budget, and then the number of people, 3.2 million people in uniform, active reserve guard, and a very large civilian workforce that make up that 3.2 million people. So it's the scope. It's also the complexity of the mission. We, like many federal agencies, have a limited number of missions here. We have to think of ourselves as an organization that's doing, we're spending over the department over $60 billion in research and development, almost $6 billion in military construction in a year. Then there are the war fighting, the overseas contingency operations that we're involved in. But there are also lots of infrastructure and support activities that go on in the Department of Defense, a huge healthcare system, a school system, lots and lots of things that go on to enable the department to complete its mission.
How did your experience at FDIC inform the way that you're leading the office here? How did that different scope, size, and so on, but similar concepts behind it, prepare you to come into this position?
Well, I certainly learned the mission. I think one of the key things about being an IG is knowing what to audit and what to investigate, and developing a process for selecting those topics, and understanding a risk assessment process to identify where to deploy auditors and investigators. And I think that's what I learned there. Another thing, though, that I learned there was that oversight is not just the IG's job, and often IGs are much more effective if they're working together. I've had several opportunities at the FDIC during the banking crisis to work on joint projects with other IGs to identify gaps or faults between oversight agencies. Mm-hmm. One very successful project we had several years ago, we were able to complete with Eric Thorson, who was and still is the IG at the Department of the Treasury. Eric and I and our offices worked on a project to determine examine one of the largest banking failures in U.S. history. And there were oversight responsibilities of that bank, and that was Washington Mutual Bank, that were shared between the Department of the Treasury and the FDIC. So it was a great opportunity for two IGs to come together. And since I've gotten here, I've realized with all of the IGs and oversight functions within the department, Learning how to work with IGs is a critically important skill that you have.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you and I have spoken on a number of occasions about collaboration in the Inspector General community. When you think about some of the work that you did along the lines of what General Reimer is talking about, what are the most important things that maybe IGs don't know they're stepping into when they get into those collaborative situations?
Well, Francis, thanks for having me on again, and great to be here. Great to see you, John.
Good.
And working with IGs is certainly a unique sort of experience. Back when I was involved in the National Procurement Fraud Task Force, we used to show that video of herding cats. IGs are very independent. They have their own ways of doing things, their own opinions. And it can be difficult to work together. And you know, I know John has worked together well with many IGs in the banking area, and now with these with the lead IG. At first it was difficult to get IGs all on the same page, but once we did, we all saw the benefits of it. I think now IGs are more willing to work together and to kind of see the benefit of being on the same page on a particular issue.
I would agree. Most of the things that we face, are problems or challenges the government faces, are not are usually solved by multiple agencies. So creating teams of IGs to oversee broader problems makes a lot of sense. I mentioned the joint project we did with Treasury at the FDIC. There also this notion of creating structure around and requiring IGs to cooperate in a certain fashion is gaining popularity, I think, in the Congress. There's an organization called the Council of Inspectors General for Financial Oversight that grew out of the banking crisis and then the Dodd-Frank Act. Which creates among those financial oversight IGs a structure where they can plan, they can identify projects, they can identify joint risks shared by their agencies. So that is, Brian also mentioned lead IG, which we'll hopefully we'll have a little bit of time to talk about in a little bit more depth. But I think it's the same notion. It's the same notion where a law is enacted requiring IGs to work together to produce certain reports, to go through certain planning processes, I think it's probably something we're going to see more of.
Well, that's where I wanted to go next. What's your takeaway from that idea of a lead IG, and what are the benefits and maybe pros and cons that you've seen in working in that structure?
Well, I think the structure, let me define it just a little bit. Lead IG is a came about through the National Defense Authorization Act of 2013, which amended the Inspector General Act, and the lead IG is a the lead IG is selected from three IGs: the Department of Defense IG, the Department of State, and USAID IG. And that selection is made by the chair of the Council of Inspectors General. Right now, that's Michael Horowitz at Department of Justice. So in the event of an overseas contingency operation, like we have now with Operation Inherent Resolve, which is the operation to defeat ISIL in Syria and Iraq, once that operation was named, SIGI, or Michael Horowitz, had 60 days to name a lead IG from the three IGs I mentioned. Since this is obviously principally a DOD mission, it made sense that the DOD Inspector General was selected. And with that selection, I designated Steve Lenick, the Inspector General at the Department of State, as the Associate IG. Essentially, and Steve is helping us in this process with all the investigative matters. So he's heading up the investigations, and I'm doing the bulk of the audit work. But lead IG really is a great means, in my mind, to create an oversight structure that doesn't have to stop we're with the boundaries of a particular federal agency. An example I would give is in Iraq, we have certainly most of the logistical support services, the care and feeding kinds of things for folks in Iraq, whether they're Department of State or Department of Defense, it's the Department of State's responsibility for that support function. Now, if there are issues in the contracts under that support function, as the lead IG, I can, with the help of the Department of State IG, we can look at both sides of the transaction. That's what I'm really trying to get at. We can, we have the authority to look at how that's working, whether it's effective, whether it's there's proper oversight of the contract, and all of the things associated with it.
What have been the keys to success of that relationship for the period of time that you've been engaged in it?
I think the notion that we are the three IGs, we worked a great deal on this approach, created an approach really through most of 2014, and came to know each other not just at the principals level, but all throughout the organizations. There were a series of working groups, probably a total of hundreds of folks actually involved in building this and in determining how we're going to go about it, what processes and procedures will be used. So I think that the key here was a great deal of planning. It was an interesting event. We certainly, the authorization for Lead IG was passed with the NDAA in 2013. So we had most of 2014 to put it together. We put it together and really in the hope, though, that we wouldn't have to use it. We were, and lo and behold, in the Operation Inherent Resolve, the campaign against ISIL, came about later in 2014. So we had to pull those processes and procedures off the shelf and execute.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the success has been, as we gather around the table with representatives from all three of those OIGs, I have seen very little institutional protectionism, I would call it. We are there in the room as auditors and investigators, not as employees of the Department of Defense or the Department of State or USAID. So the common mission of oversight really seems to be the binding thing that makes us work together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really been an eye opener to see that, and we've in a very, very little, not much friction at all. That I would say. I think we've worked remarkably well together, considering we're a sort of an ad hoc group that's come together fairly quickly.
John, is the idea of a lead IG something that you think should be applied in other areas, or does it have a future?
Well, I think the notion, I think it has to be need-based. I would go back to what I talked about Dodd-Frank and the Council of Inspectors General for Financial Oversight. I think that, in a sense, is, although not called lead IG, it exists. It can't, it's in the law. It's an IG structure that exists to provide oversight over a broad program that exceeds the bounds of an individual agency. So whether it's lead IG, whether it's councils of IGs created to oversee mm-hmm. certain problems or government programs, yes, I think it will continue.
The mechanisms that you mentioned, the working groups and so on, that you believe have led or are leading to the success that you're seeing in the lead IG concept, are they the same kinds of mechanisms that you could see in formalized relationships like you just mentioned, or more informal one-off type audits and investigations where you're working with another agency's inspector general? Or is there something unique about the lead IG mechanism or the other things that maybe those lessons wouldn't apply?
I think the thing that's unique is in this case is we are required, as all IGs are, but we were required to put together essentially a joint planning document, and that's really been the driver
mm-hmm.
for us. And that joint planning document, we put it together. It's required under the law, had to be published. That really has been a tremendous tool for us, because we're not We had a series of meetings to develop that, and it came again. It's a document that came from everyone, all three of the IGs, understanding of the mission or their part of the mission, and principally in Iraq right now, and what the risks associated with that are. So we had three different perspectives to put together that joint operating plan, and I think that's been the key.
And that sounds like the best first step in any relationship between any two offices that may be working together in the future.
I think when Brian was talking a moment ago about maybe some occasions where it joint project work with IGs, some folks have been reluctant to do that, and it certainly I think gained some more popularity more recently. But in the cases where I've been involved in it, you have to have a plan up front. You have to think through the entire process. Don't just look at the whatever the risk is that's been identified in an audit or an investigation and go out and start looking at documents and interviewing people. You have to say, what are we trying to find? How will we report it? How will we document it? How will we report it? Who's in charge? Who owns the document when we're finished? Essentially, there are a lot of things that have to be done up front. And if the upfront work is done, then I think joint oversight is a great way to get at issues that span more than one federal agency.
Before we change gears, any other things on your mind regarding the way that you interact with other inspectors general across government?
Well, I have always been, in addition to what we've learned with Lead IG and some of the financial oversight work I did years ago, always been a big advocate of and a big supporter of the Council of Inspectors General for SIGI, and SIGI being the Council of Inspectors General. I have been involved in the audit committee of that organization for many years, and the audit committee's principal responsibility is developing common standards and training for IGs. So yes, I think the notion that IGs are much more effective working together with common sets with common approaches to problems, common training, has always been very important to me, and I've been involved in that my entire time I've been in the federal government.
We've seen that a lot more, I think, in the past year or 18 months with the letters that the IG community signed together collaboratively and sent to members of Congress and so on. That appeared to me as an outsider to be the next step in the maturation of the community of inspectors general. What do you think the next two or three steps in that evolution might be?
Well, I think what I would like to see, documented processes on how we should work together. So we're not, when we come together, either Lead IG or through a financial oversight mechanism, so there are processes that are predetermined. Who determines what a particular audit plan will look like? Who will own the work papers when the work is finished? Who has responsibility for reporting to Congress? Who has responsibility for working with the press or with the media as we go through that? So I think more of that standard operating procedures on how we would work together when we do come together would be a helpful next step for SIGI, because that's still a little bit ad hoc.
That you kind of answered my next question, which is that something that you think should live in SIGI, or is that something that you anticipate legislative prescriptions for, or where will that come from that it's best functional for the inspector general community?
I think it will. I think it can grow in SIGI. I think we have a pretty good history within the council of identifying problems and coming together as a community and creating work groups to solve those problems. I don't think it has to be a legislative fix. I think we have a great history of growing things within the community.
And there's not, it doesn't sound to me at least anyway, like there are any authorities that you would need to ask for legislative prescriptive from.
I would think that those kinds of arrangements would exist once those processes and procedures are developed, and let's say two IGs came together tackle a common problem, then the authority comes from each of the IGs already have, mm-hmm. and would be documented in memorandums of understanding between the IGs.
Any concerns about in any kind of cross-agency collaboration among IGs about dismissal of recommendations coming from the other agency's IG by the first agency?
I think you have
you're not my guy, so I don't have to pay attention to you.
You have to be careful when you come to those recommendations that they would be issued by the appropriate IG. I mean, I would be very reluctant, and certainly you can see where folks would challenge authority if I were working on a joint project with the Department of State. And there's a DOD IG report directed at state. That wouldn't work. Now, what would work is that the portion of a report or a joint project that identifies deficiencies in one agency or another, really those deficiencies have to come from the agency's IG.
Mm-hmm. Brian, I want to transition to the idea of the balance that you and I have discussed before between cooperation and collaboration with the leadership at an agency and maintenance of independence. And that's been an issue that the IG community's kind of been in the spotlight for, the question of independence. What has been your experience with the maybe one, two, or three best ways to maintain that right balance?
Well, Francis, I think communication is key to any relationship. It's key to the relationship between an IG and head of the agency. I think understanding their roles. Sometimes there's a learning curve on both sides. I think just being fair, getting to know the head of the agency as well, and they know how you think, you know, how they think, I think all that helps. There are times when you will have differences of opinion, and there are times when an IG will have to say, this is how it should be done, or you know, what you have done has a deficiency, and here's a recommendation. It's a difficult process. People are humans, and so they all have flaws, but I think sincere people can come to a reasonable agreement.
What do you think the keys are, Mr. Reimer, to the success of the relationship that you have with OSD and with particularly with Secretary Carter?
Well, I think it's just as following up on what Brian was saying, the relationship has to be one of let's say the IG has to be a person known to not to be biased, not to favor one notion, one person over another. So it really has to be fact-based. I mean, I think you have to be able to demonstrate in your work that you are relying on the facts, whether the facts that portray the agency in a good light or the facts that portray the agency in a bad light. And once you establish with the leadership that's your game, it is not to try to find favor or try to always find fault. It's report fairly what you find. And I think once you do that and you establish the ground rules up front that you certain things that you don't talk about findings without facts. You don't let leadership influence findings. There are certain times when you can release reports and they have to be in certain format in terms of being final, things of that nature. So a good deal of it is a relationship that, or an IG, establishing the fact that they're going to be influenced by facts, not influenced by opinion or not pushed one way or another because of politics.
Trust sounds like it's at the root of that relationship then.
Trust and, yes, I think so.
And respect, each for each other's role.
What's the key, do you think, to driving that respect? The trust part is easy to understand because it's an ongoing demonstration, both parts, that each side is sincere about accepting and presenting factual information. But the respect part, is that just the basic respect that any human shows to any other human that allows that to perpetuate itself? Or is there something special and unique about an inspector general and agency leader relationship in that area?
Well, I think part of it is, again, it's fact-based, but it's also, to the fullest extent possible, no surprises. When we are releasing a draft report to the department, and that's the point where the department has the opportunity to write a response, my instructions to my auditors is that when management receives that draft, they should already know what the issues are. There should be no surprises at that stage. So, and there still may be differences, and there usually are. I mean, with audit findings, but there should be no surprises. Mm-hmm. So it's one to be as transparent as possible through the process, and create an environment where communication is a key component to the relationship.
I want to go back to a theme that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation to wrap us up, John. You talked about the selection process briefly, about how important it is to know what you should investigate and audit. How do you make that decision in an organization, as you mentioned, with a $600 billion a year budget and the, 600 to 800,000 employees, both civilian and uniformed, and then the contractors that are serving the Defense Department as well. It's a lot of ground to cover there.
It's a lot of ground to cover, and you can't cover it all with the large size of our office and all the other oversight components within the department. My approach is one of, first of all, you have to understand that a certain amount of that ground is covered for you by the Congress. Some percentage, and I think here it's as much as a third of our work, at least on the audit side, is determined in statute. And there may be some other percentage that's requested by committees or individual members. So there's a fairly significant portion of the work that comes from the Congress. Then there is some of the work will be requested by the leadership of the organization. And then there's that discretionary piece really that the IG has. And let's just pick a number. Let's say that's 50% of my audit capacity is something that I can control. We start here with a process that's really ground up from the perspective that we start with, I will identify what I believe are the greatest risk, a group. This year I think we had 15 key areas that we believed should have some kind of audit coverage or investigative coverage. And those become, in our organization, the IG priorities. And then from there, those are doled out to our different directorates within the office. And a process that starts with the individual auditor. The auditors, in my mind, are the most familiar with where the risks are in an organization. So if we have a group of auditors that are doing contracting work, and contracting is certainly something that gets a lot of attention around here, then it's those folks that will identify the next set of contract audits that should be done. Then we'll bring that together, and it'll move up through the organization, and we'll have to do, we won't be able to do all we want to do. And then we'll have to go through a series of really of risk-based paring those down. With Lead IG and Inherent Resolve, some of the approach that we've taken, for example, if we'd like to always have a good body of work in contract oversight, but since we have the Operation Inherent Resolve going on, some of that contract oversight are going to be contracts that are in Kuwait, in Iraq, just simply because of the added risk. You have a certain amount of financial risk, but now you have the environmental risk to go with it, so we'll direct it that way. But it's very much, in this organization at least, we establish the priorities, and then we work from the auditor up and get input from the agency as well. I spend a fair amount of my time when we develop the audit plan for Operation Inherent Resolve. The first place we went was to the Middle East, and then met with members of Army Central Command and in CENTCOM to look at their view of where the risk of the operation is. So you have to understand it from an auditor's perspective, and you also have to understand it from the leadership's perspective.
Brian, I've had a chance to ask the questions that I want, so I'll leave the last question to you if you'd like.
John, what do you find most rewarding about being an IG?
Well, I think it's when you have an opportunity to identify something that is that has been a long-term problem, and you can and work with the department for a long-term solution. Something around here that was started before I got here, but we're continuing, is spare parts. So over the years, the Department of Defense has spent lots and lots of money on things it didn't need, and they're literally warehouses full of spare parts. And we've really, through a number of reports over a number of years, really brought that to light, started quantifying that, and I think we're helping to fix some of those problems.
John, I'm very grateful for your time to talk about the work that you're doing here. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Brian, thank you as well.
Thank you, Francis.